It is Saturday, January 14th, 2011. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio. In the first half of Geek Speak, we'll do geek news. In the second half, we'll welcome your questions and comments about technology. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. We appreciate his time and energy in creating some content for our show. If you'd like to create content for our show, please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy and sometimes instructor. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Is that me?
Well, we're doing a few new things today on the system, and Ben, I am unsure if you're on mic. Go ahead and speak into that mic.
Hello.
I don't think so.
No.
Jesse Wilkins, hi.
How's it going?
Oh, you sound beautiful.
Excellent.
Gosh, delicious.
She's going to have to steal your mic, Jesse.
You guys are going to have to share. Why don't you slide that mic over to split between the two of you, if you wouldn't mind. Go ahead. And we'll turn that back up. Let me introduce Jesse Wilkins as they're setting up. Jesse Wilkins is owner and operator of Computer Center of Santa Cruz, formerly MC Squared Computer Consulting. Now, MC Squared was around for a long time. I didn't know it went out, but you actually took over the business, Jesse?
It was, yeah. They were actually around like 1994 to 2010. I took it over in 2011, revamped it a bit, and it's been going strong.
And you did change the name.
I did. It's now Computer Center Santa Cruz, and I've been doing my own consulting for the last 10 or so years locally, and now I do both.
And I've had you on probably once a year for the last 3 years or so.
It's been about right.
When people contact me in the community asking for tech support, I normally refer them to you.
And right? I'm happy to help.
You're the guy that normally takes them. So if you want to keep trying to play with that microphone.
Well, it goes into a jack on the wall. I'm not really sure where the jack on the wall goes.
You don't want to rewire the whole thing, huh?
You know what? No.
I think I might know what it is. So we'll definitely. Well, let's just keep.
We'll keep playing.
Okay. So thanks Jesse for being here. If you want to learn more about Jesse, you can go to Computer Center of Santa Cruz. Computer Center Santa Cruz. Right?
Yes. No of.
Okay. ComputerCenterSantaCruz.com. We'll have that up at GeekSpeak.
What was that again?
Let's not do it again. But let's talk a little bit about. Oh, I don't know. It's been a while. Facebook.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Facebook has started doing things that are newsworthy, which usually means Facebook is doing things that are bad. So as many, many, many people have predicted, Facebook is now displaying ads in the news feed. So, of course, they introduced the news feed, has all the, you know, the different things that your friends are doing and everything. And, of course, now they're using that as an outlet for ads. Now, one of the things that's really frustrating about this, though, is not just that they're displaying ads in it, in the newsfeed. It's also that those ads, it's not very clear that they're ads. Down at the bottom right of it, it says featured. And before, they've used sponsored. They say sponsored for all their ads, but now they say featured. So that's a little bit weird. If you roll over, it says someone, a sponsor paid to feature it here and all that stuff. But not very many people are going to see that. Probably not many people are going to get that it's an ad, which is exactly what the advertisers want and exactly what is not great for the users, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's definitely a tricky thing. You'll see this in magazines all the time where a company will buy a full page ad and in the full page ad,
okay, is the mic working now? No, it's not.
It really isn't. It's just not loud enough.
That's
I mean,
okay.
I can hear a tap, but it's just not working. So
yeah.
In any case, a full-page ad in a magazine will be very clear that it's an ad if it's structured correctly, right? But sometimes they'll try to put in kind of a fake story in it so it looks like the magazine. Mm-hmm. I see this in Consumer Reports all the time. And it's tricky because, of course, the people that are selling them advertising want to the actual person at the company that's selling the advertising to some advertiser wants to make that advertiser happy, so they give all this money. And at the same time, you don't want to trick your audience. You don't want to degrade your quality of your journalism, if you will. But Facebook, of course it's ads. I mean, I think of everything that's not coming directly from a friend as an ad. There's been a big bar on the side for quite a while, which is, you know, local events, things like that nature. I've always thought of that as an ad. There's one that always shows up, a bucket list for Santa Cruz. I don't know if that was one that, I mean, depends on where you live, what you get. But that's always kind of been like an ad in my perspective. This is different, though.
Well, let me just read directly from Facebook's help center thing. It says, businesses can pay to feature a post so there's a better chance you'll see it. A quick example of how it works. One, let's say that you like your gym's Facebook page. Two, some friends see the story in their news feeds and other people may miss it. So you like something, some of your friends see it, some people may miss it. Three, the owner of the gym can pay to feature the story.
What's a gym?
Gym.
Gym?
Like,
oh, the gym.
Gymnasium.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. The owner of the gym.
It's a bad sign that I don't know what that is.
Can pay to feature the story so your friends are more likely to see it.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically taking some of the content that you produce as a user and bumping it up. So
with
it's
money.
With money. So it's higher and so it's more visible. And
they've been doing this for a while.
But not in the news feed like
oh,
this.
Oh, not in the news feed. So
not
it's
in
really
feed.
Hard to denote that there's any difference from your normal feed.
Yeah,
news
exactly.
Feed, the ads were off to the side. Okay, I got what you're saying.
Yeah, in addition, like I mentioned, it doesn't just say sponsored now. It says featured. They've changed the diction so it looks like it's a featured story, not a story someone paid to sponsor.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a little weird, a little sketchy.
Yeah,
I feel weird about it.
All right. Good to know.
You know, it's interesting in relation to security. I don't know if does Facebook only do their own internal ads, whereas if you go to any general website that's, you know, serving up ads from Google or any other ad source, that's a big security risk. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But if it's only Facebook doing their own ads, that might actually be a safer way to get ads on your computer than, say, a random website ad you click on.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I still feel weird about it. So. Good job, Facebook.
All right, Jesse, what's up with cell phones lately?
So cell phones, interestingly enough, CES was going on this week. That's the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I think they said 150,000 people or something like that went. Something
big show.
Crazy.
Yeah. It's a lot of human sandbags.
Oh, man. So I ran across an article the other day about liquipel.com, and they waterproof your cell phones. Now, I've gone a little further into that, and there are other companies that do waterproofing, water-resistant stuff, varying ways to do it. They say they use nanotechnology to basically embed protection into all the components in your cell phone. So you can pour water on it, you can drop it in your toilet possibly and not have it break.
Do you know anything about the technology? Do they actually take apart the phone to do this?
No, they don't. Liquipel actually uses some kind of like vacuum chamber, and they inject this nano gas into the chamber, and it penetrates your phone, every part of it, and then the phone actually works exactly as it did before.
Okay, so the one part of that that doesn't feel right to me is that there's a microphone and a speaker on this thing, and those are both very sensitive. If you've ever taken apart a headphone, I know Ben and I always mess around with headphones as they break, we take them apart.
Certainly.
It's a very thin fiber that actually vibrates. And that thin fiber, you add anything to it, you're going to change the dynamics of the speaker.
It's interesting. You know, I was thinking the same, and they say if anything, it actually enhances the life because it makes the speaker
stronger
or less water permeable, flame from moisture in the air. So it sounds like it's technology we don't quite comprehend on a day-to-day basis.
Now, if it's truly something at the nanoscale, absolutely. Things happen different there. But I don't imagine, I mean, it's probably some kind of, you know, it's a chemical thing, right? It just feels to me like if you could do that, companies would do that more often. Like, it must change the dynamics of the system.
I don't know.
The other thing that's interesting, I mean, if you did have a perfect insulator around all the electronics in the system, submerging in water would matter, right? Because if you had a perfect insulator.
Yep.
But an insulator normally denotes a thickness. Because anything that's too thin, the spark can just fly right through. So you have to have a really good insulator so that you're not, you know, allowing the water... dirty stuff in the water to short out the circuitry of the phone. It's actually not pure water is not going to really do anything to the phone except for make it sound bad. Ben, you had a second?
Conductibility of electricity, couldn't it?
Well,
create like, you know, bridge between two connectors within the phone since everything's so close together. Even if it's pure water.
If you really need the you need other stuff in the water,
like salt or something.
Yeah, now all water has that, right?
Okay,
and then of course, even if you put the phone directly right into completely pure water, your hand, there's gunk in the phone that then mixes around. So it's not a good thing to do.
It's interesting because you'll see stories of people dropping their phones in their toilets or spilling stuff on them. And, you know, sometimes the story's like, hey, it worked perfect afterwards. Other
right.
times, it dies instantly.
Right.
So really, how can you determine what's going to happen? You can't. You know, cross your fingers.
I mean, it's a complicated problem. I mean, Apple has that whole thing where inside their device, they have a little dye pack, mm-hmm. a little piece of paper that has some material on it. When it gets wet, it changes color. So once you bring a phone in, you say, oh, something's wrong with it. They look in, you go, yeah, because it got wet.
They're like, sorry, go away.
Yeah, because it's such a complicated problem.
You know, I'm always wondering when they invoke the term nanotechnology, what they really mean by that, you know? Because nanotechnology is a fairly specific thing, but as all technologies of this sort has so many different potential
sure.
applications. So are they using, like, is it actually some kind of nano this or that thing that's going into the phone? Or is it some technology they're using to create something that goes into the phone? Or like,
right.
how, where is nanotechnology
right.
in this?
And I would just assume, my perspective is there's inert, if you will, nanoparticles. Not inert in the sense of, normally when you think about nanotechnology, you think of little nanites, little robotic things at the nanoscale. That doesn't function right now. Like,
yeah.
That's not something we're doing.
Not Star Trek Borg nanoprobes.
But there are really amazing materials that, because of their nanostructure, their low-level structure, operate in ways we wouldn't expect. The example of that is a gecko foot, right? That the gecko foot, the reason why it can stick to glass and they can walk up glass or any kind of slick surface is because the actual structure goes to the nanoscale. There's fibers of the nanoscale. The surface area is so immense because of that. That's a simple way of thinking about it. But the actual, it's kind of like, because that gecko's foot has that nano property, it's doing a chemical reaction to things that it attaches to, right? It's almost like a chemical reaction. It's using the what you would normally think of as a chemical reaction to connect and disconnect. So in any case, it gets in that weird space. That's why the nanoscale is really interesting. So if they are doing something, that's great. But to me, it just sounds like a buzzword and bull. But if they can submerge phones in water and it works, cool.
Certainly.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, so there's another website called Waterfied, waterfi.com. And it looks like they do a quote-unquote better version of this where you can submerge your phone, say, 30 feet underwater as opposed
I'd
to
love
being
to see
water resistant.
You know what we'll do is we'll link all this to geekspeak.org. I put the show up a couple days after now because the system is a little different at this point. But I'll make sure to put these URLs up on our site if you're interested.
Well, every time I go swimming with my phone, I get fewer dropped calls.
Yes.
So I don't know if I'm doing something right or wrong.
Have you ever submerged your phone?
No, actually, I've never. I'm sorry,
but
I just lied.
You want a new phone,
I just
right?
lied on the air. I feel like a bad person. If anyone from any of these companies wants to provide us with technical information about this,
oh, sure.
we will totally cover it on the air.
We'll cover
this
it a little
cool.
more. All right, let's talk about space, I guess, right?
Yeah, right. That's
Why
an
not?
Obvious
you're
transition.
You're the space guy, Ben.
So I want to talk a little bit about dark matter. So some researchers, astronomers, have actually mapped out a very, very large section of the universe, the dark matter in a large section of the universe. So dark matter, it's pretty much pervades the entire universe. It accounts for 83% of the mass of the cosmos, right? But the special thing about this dark matter is that we can't see it. We can't detect it in any way except the way it gravitationally influences things around it that we can observe. So that's
well,
kind of the problem with dark matter and trying to understand it. But looking at all of this old light coming that's been traveling for eons from all these stars really far away, and looking at where we know these stars to be, we've actually created a very large map of the dark matter in the universe, 1 billion light years across. Not incredible resolution or anything, but we've got this pretty amazing map. So it's pretty interesting. It was used. They used a 340 megapixel camera that they have at the Canada France Hawaii telescope. I'm not sure where that's actually located. The Canada France Hawaii telescope. They call it the MegaCam. So they put all this together, and it's kind of interesting to be able to actually see in some kind of visual way where all this stuff is, you know,
or where it influences things.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't really know what it is. So to say where it is a little strange, but we know where the influence of dark matter is.
It is strange, but we know it. I assume, and I might be completely off on this, if any theoretical physicists mm-hmm. want to correct me, but I assume that dark matter has a position, and that's how it can impact light as it travels past.
I think to say that something that you don't know what it is has a position is a little strange. Like, you can't really say that that has a position. You know what
you
it's
say
a, you
it,
know what's being affected by this thing we don't understand. But to
but
say
you don't
that
know
you know
position.
Where it is a little
okay. Fine. Point taken.
It's definitely not that important.
Well,
where it's being influenced.
Let me rephrase it then. We have a map of all the places where the dark matter influences most heavily and least heavily.
Yeah, good. I like
so that. That's a more technical definition. A little less colloquial, but
right,
pretty
you.
Interesting. And hey, I'll post the story up on geekspeak.org.
Got a new little... Thank you. And we'll have that up later today or tomorrow or the next day.
Someday.
Last week. it's a complicated process now, folks. But in any case, I want to suggest a new idea for GeekSpeak. We're doing a little segment called Know a Term. I'm going to read the introductory paragraph of a term on Wikipedia. It's a technically based term without saying the word of it. And you guys are going to tell me if you know what it is. All right?
This sounds dangerous. You're exposing our ignorance.
Yeah, okay.
We need Miles here.
A blank. Whatever the word is.
A something.
A is a list or register of entities who, for one reason or another, are being denied a particular privilege, service, mobility, access, or recognition. As a verb to means blank, right? Can mean to deny someone work in a particular field or to ostracize a person from a certain social circle. And there is a term that's converse to this that's very popular as well. So do you know the two terms?
I like your answer. Does he chicken?
What was it? Chicken?
A chicken.
Okay, let's see. A chicken is a list or register. No.
Man.
Well, how do you know? We don't understand everything about chickens, you know?
So you got an idea? It's okay if you
I got one.
Okay, Ben?
Go for it.
Blacklist?
Nice. A blacklist is a list or registry of entities who, for one reason or another, are being denied a particular privilege, service, mobility, access, or recognition. That's right, blacklist. That's one I want to talk about. And the converse to that, Jesse, you know what a converse to blacklist is?
A whitelist.
A whitelist, yes. Thank you for sharing the mics, by the way. The station was able to get some funding to revamp all the technology, and in doing that, we're moved from our main production room into a new production room with completely new equipment. So the show's a little different today, if you might have noticed from the mic juggling. But I think I appreciate you, Ben and Jesse, doing this appropriately.
And
we'll really show our colors when we take calls in about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But so a blacklist, it's a very interesting idea and term. Whitelist and blacklist are very cool ideas in tech. And so I want to make sure that everybody understands what that is. Basically, if I were to go from my home and go visit a website, there's no blocking at all. I'm totally available to visit any website I want. If I go to a work environment, sometimes the work environment will produce security measures that enforce only certain websites to be visited. Most of the time what they do is they subscribe to a company that has a giant blacklist that all the bad sites on the internet. And what happens is as sites are added to that blacklist from that company, you can't access them at work. And this is kind of cool. The idea behind it, of course, is you don't want your employees to do things like chat about company secrets on a public environment, go look at porn all day, participate in Facebook, maybe, depending on what you want your employees to do. So since it's your computer system and your services, the company, you might want to add restrictions. And the way they mostly do this is blacklist. And the reason for that is it's very difficult to say all the places you should visit, and maybe a little easier to say all the places you shouldn't. And that line is actually quite complicated. I tend to think that whitelists are much safer. Right now, this blacklist, whitelist thing is very, it happens in computer programs as well when you install stuff. Microsoft has a signature authority and can sign applications. Companies that make software can sign applications. That's kind of like a whitelist, you know, in that function that if it's got a certificate, we can trust it. Ben?
So I've got a comparison. If you're going through the airport, if you're on the do not fly list, you're on the blacklist.
That's right.
If you're the president of the United States, even if someone accidentally adds you to the do not fly list, you're really actually on a whitelist, right?
That's nice. Yeah.
No matter what happens, you're going to be able to fly because you're the president.
Right.
So there's kind of the comparison, right? All the rest of us, we're not on a whitelist, on a blacklist. Our credentials are tested when we go through airport security, or I'll put tested in air quotes.
And the blacklist originated with England's King Charles II. He made made of 58 judges and court officers who sentenced his father, Charles, to death in 1649. So when Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660, 13 of these regencies, basically 13 people were killed because of the blacklist. So it's the way of saying this is no good. Now, the trouble with blacklists for spam, for example, is it doesn't work. You'll notice that we still have a lot of spam. Even though everybody that produces a web service at some level has to block IP addresses and do these blacklistings. And there's sites out there that actually consume kind of collect blacklists so that your mail server can stop, you know, ignore those sites. But it's very tricky. If for some reason your IP address does get on that list, it's hard to remove it. Then your machine gets fixed. How do you prove it? So blacklists are dangerous in that perspective. And we also use it, I use it in my mail filters. If someone is in my address book, it doesn't matter if it's what the content of the message is, I'm going to get it because I've already added them to my address book and I'm using that address book as a whitelist. So if you're in my address book, the mail doesn't go to my spam filters, even if it's spam.
Well, unless, of course, if someone else is running a blacklist and their name gets on that blacklist that isn't you. So if your ISP is in charge or if you work for a company, so it's not just down to the user end. It's always who's in charge really in the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, now, it's always a bit more complex now when you have different,
Right. Now, there's this bill we talk about. We talk about SOPA a lot and Protect IP, these two bills in the House and the Senate. And one of the things that they're doing is they're saying, we're going to produce a structure that will allow us to allow the federal government to blacklist. And the problem is that it's not a very effective way of targeting a bad guy on the internet because by inherent quality, the internet has this kind of universal anybody can do anything space. So when you decide to say, well, we're going to start blocking certain things by a blacklist, you don't really know if you're getting everybody. You're not. You never will. And you don't know if you've gotten someone incorrectly. And those two problems make blacklists very difficult to manage. And whitelists from that perspective as well.
Yeah, it's true. I agree with everything you said.
So one thing I wanted to mention on the show, this idea, well, we can move on. But let's go ahead and first learn a little bit more about what's going on in the Windows protection space and viruses and things of that nature. Ben, are you running Windows personally?
No.
Yeah.
And I'm shying away from it as much as possible.
Yeah, and so. I run Windows every once in a while, but I don't have 7 running, right? I'm still running Vista because I just don't use it very often. And when I set up a machine for my son, I went ahead and went to Ubuntu, which is a Linux derivative. So...
So you got all three running, huh?
I got all three running.
Nice.
I prefer, in this order, Macintosh OS, then Linux, and then Windows. If I want to feel good about myself, I'll use Unix first. Linux first, excuse me. So, Jesse, you're dealing with people having viruses and problems all the time.
Indeed.
What is your preferred antivirus solution? Or do you not care that much as long as they've got one?
You know, it's sort of interesting. This is a multi-pronged answer. It's not just about antivirus software. It's about how you use your computer to browse the internet. So for Windows users, and yes, I use all three as well, my primary computer is Windows, now Windows 7. I just upgraded a couple weeks ago. It's great. I love it. I'm working on a Mac laptop right now, and I've got an Ubuntu computer at home as well. The biggest thing I tell people these days is to do safe browsing practices. So stick to websites you know, Yahoo, Hotmail, etc.
Use a whitelist.
You know, use what you know is big. So that's number one. And then, of course, you want to have your security on your computer. Antivirus software, anti-spyware software. So do you
think of those things as two different things?
I do, indeed. Now, there are suites, which, like, say, Norton and McAfee and a bunch of the big antivirus companies roll together a big package where it's antivirus, anti-spyware, firewall, identity theft protection, etc. And then you can also make your own. You can take, say, an AVG's free antivirus software. You can take Malwarebytes anti-spyware program. You can take Zone Alarm Firewall and control it all yourself. But, you know, it's a bit more work because then you've got three pieces of software to update. You've got more to manage.
Do you think it's appropriate for a Windows user not to be running virus protection software or anti-spyware stuff? Is that something you can actually do in Windows?
You can. I've actually got a couple clients who shun it, and they've never had a problem.
Interesting.
So
now, they do have a firewall of some sort, either a router on the front
end.
They've
got a home router. You know, they only do their work on that computer. So they do tax work. And so they go to, like, Lacerte, they go to QuickBooks, and that's it. So they've got the internet access so they can do their email, but they don't browse the internet. So right there, that keeps you from having to worry about updating your browser, from having to worry about updating Flash and Java as much. Now, other people say, hey, if you're on the internet, you're going to get infected if you're not protected. Yeah. And I've read plenty of articles that say, hey, if your computer's online, if you're not protected.
Well, one of the things that occurs, you know, even if you're not doing that kind of thing, let's say you get an email and the email has a URL that looks like an okay URL.
Uh-huh.
You click on it. Now you're in the wild.
Yep.
You know, that's the thing about, like, letting kids play on the internet. Right?
Yeah, they don't know what to click on, what not to click on.
One click and you're in, you know, the worst part of the worst part of one horrible city with a riot going on.
It's unlike real life, where if you're driving around Santa Cruz, you're not going to appear in necessarily a bad part of Santa Cruz.
Well, that's the thing.
On the internet,
that's the thing is that we don't think about ourselves being able to teleport anywhere we want. That's a very dangerous thing to do.
That could be dangerous.
But on the internet, you can teleport wherever you want.
And so, that's what happens. That's what all the links, all the ads, that's what I was saying before. If you click on some random banner ad that may have been infected or might just take you to somewhere unsafe.
See, for a while I was in this perspective of you do browsing safe, you're going to be okay. And if you do something, but that slip of a click happens.
Yes.
It's an easy thing to happen. I do a lot of right-clicking on things to see what the URL is, or copy it and then paste it into text edit to see what's going on. And my keyboard that I use at my desk does not have a function key. My laptop directly has a function key. So sometimes I will hit the function key instead, and I have what I thought was right-clicked but actually clicked.
Sure.
Right? So even a pretty experienced user can make a mistake like that. All of a sudden I'm visiting a site that has something nasty. Let's say there's a lot of ways of nasty sites getting in your machine. Flash vulnerabilities emerge all the time. Adobe Acrobat vulnerabilities emerge all the time.
Yeah, so the other part of that is staying updated. And again, most people don't spend the time to update their Flash, update their Java, update their Adobe Reader, update their web browser, update Windows, update blah, 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 blah. I mean, yeah, you could spend a full day every month or more often than that updating all your computers. And so that's where they have consultants like me, say for bigger companies, they go in there and do it all for you. Recently, I ran across a piece of software called Secunia PSI, and they actually have like an automated updater that installs itself on your computer and pays attention to all your software and will update it for you automatically if you want it to. They've got a free version, a pro version. Check it out if you don't want to update it yourself. And it's Secunia PLI.
We'll put that at geekspeak.org. Too many girls on air as hard as hard. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In KUSP studios with me is Jesse Wilkins. He owns and runs ComputerCenterSantaCruz.com. And also Ben Jaffe. And Ben Jaffe's a freelance media guy. And actually, you currently now have a job.
I do.
And you have a home.
I'm a front-end mobile developer. Not mobile as in moving around, as you pointed out.
Now you live at one place, but you are a mobile developer.
I live in one. Yeah, right. I traded mobile lifestyle for the developer.
Hey, Bullseye is a public radio program about what's good in pop culture, popular culture, with a keen editorial eye of host and UCSC alum Jesse Thorne. Jesse Thorne's awesome. Bullseye is equal parts funny and fascinating. Look for more information about Bullseye in the highlights section of KSP.org and listen to the program every Sunday evening between 8 and 9. Jesse Thorne, this Bullseye was formerly a reincarnation of that, was a program called Young... I shouldn't say this stuff unless I know exactly what it is. Sound of Young America. And I've been listening to it for years, and Jesse Thorne's an amazing guy. And so we're covering the show, which is wonderful. Bullseye, I recommend it. Sunday, 8 to 9 on KUSP. Ben, you want to cover a really quick thing on for our geek bit?
Sure.
I have something quick. How about Bing?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'll just run through these pretty fast. They're more extensive stories that you can look up on geekspeak.org. I'll post them. But basically, Microsoft Bing search queries have, for the first time, overtaken Yahoo.
That's big.
Which is, yeah, it's really big because Yahoo used to be the one, you know, and then Google.
Bing is Microsoft search.
Exactly, which they've been taking a loss year after year after year to run this thing. But a lot of other websites actually use Bing queries instead of Google. In addition, Google now is integrating Google Plus stories into Google web search. So if you're logged into Google now and you search for something, then you can see something that you've shared or that your friends have shared pop up near the very top. Twitter's kind of, not happy about that because they've always been the one to be the one who breaks news and everything like that. So it's kind of an interesting time. I'll post both those stories up on geekspeak.org.
Thank you so much. GeekSpeak on QSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information at 423-2447. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. We will take any questions or comments about technology at that number, and I will give that number in just one more second. But I did want to mention, for anybody in Santa Cruz, if you're interested in Linux, Larry Cafino, he's the free software guy in Felton. Hey, Jesse, you know him? You know Larry?
I don't.
He's great. He's a friend of mine. And he helps run the Felton Linux user group, and they're meeting today at 2 o'clock at the Felton Firehouse.
That's interesting.
It's a cool place. If you want to see what local Linux is doing, everybody brings their laptops. They talk about Linux. And if you've ever been curious about that kind of thing, that's the kind of space to go. You go to a place where everybody's really enthusiastic, will help you out, and you could potentially switch away from your Windows 98 install. Please don't be running Windows 98 on the internet. Again, you can call us with questions and comments about technology, and I really do assure you that we can answer anything today because we have Jesse in the house with us.
Jesse will save us.
Jesse Wilkins will save us. The phone number, again, to call us with questions and comments about technology, you want to know what's going on your computer, you need some help, give us a ring, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You guys got one more, or should we just go ahead and start taking calls?
I've got a quick little geek bit, actually.
Go for it.
But you have to ask me about these. Ask me about my slippers.
Nice slippers. Who sewed that stuff together for you?
Yeah, so just so you guys know, my slippers have two Klingon characters on them. One on the right foot, one on the left foot. My friend Mara made them for my birthday last year.
You are the geekiest person I know.
And do you know what they are?
Of course. Those are slippers.
No,
I don't know the Klingon symbols.
There's hearts on there too.
Oh my God, you're so literal. One is B, one is J for Ben Jaffe.
Oh, very cool.
They're the Klingon phonetic. Awesome. She looked up the Klingon phonetic alphabet.
Can you do J in Klingon?
Not really.
No, me neither.
Yeah, she did the closest she could. I can't remember what letter it ended up being. But
from Santa Cruz, Jamie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thank you very much. I'll try to be clear in my question. I'm 65. I'm kind of a Luddite. I don't know. You know, I'm not afraid of technology exactly. My father was a scientist, but I don't really want to do things just for the sake of doing them, and I'm fairly sort of skeptical as to whether or not I need to do something that I don't need to do.
Sounds good.
So that's my point of view. Mm-hmm. I have a regular Sony home phone with two machines, two handheld devices, so that I can just receive calls at home.
All over the house.
I saw no need to have a cell phone at all except when I was traveling.
Makes sense.
So I bought a Virgin Mobile low pay, whatever, and that seemed to function, although it was dropped out a lot of times and it was difficult to use. So on Black Friday, I bought a fancier Android from Virgin Mobile called an Enterprise or something or other, which is now $55 a month. Now, what I'm trying to understand is if I'm only at home, I really don't see a need for a cell phone at all.
Yeah.
I'm retired. I don't need to go out all the time. I don't need to fiddle with it. But I'm now taking an office. I'm a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
So the therapy office doesn't have a phone.
Mm-hmm.
So it appears that I need a cell phone. Now, how do I coordinate these two phones? Is it inevitable that I get rid of my home phone? Or is there some way to coordinate them? Or
what do you mean coordinate
them?
How do
I keep the cost down of the secondary of the cell phone?
Okay, so what do you mean coordinate them?
Well, do I have to get rid of it and join the revolution where I have where I don't have the phones where I know where they are and I have to find my cell phone when it rings and all this stuff?
Yeah, the big dilemma of whether
I have to give up the home phone.
Right, the dilemma of whether you keep the home phone. Well, if price is a concern and you have to have a cell phone, then yeah, get rid of your home phone if you're really looking for the low price. But the convenience factor, I got to say, I can't stand not having a home phone now that I've got kids around the house, right? Mm. The phones ring. I've got my phone. My girlfriend has her phone. The kids don't have a phone. They have to ask for our phones. They're delicate, so we have to be careful, make sure they sit on the couch, all that thing. When I was a kid, the phone was a public part of the house, right? The phone rang. Anybody got to it, answered it.
Right.
Who we want to talk to? It became a way of connecting the home together. And I kind of missed that aspect. So from that side, I wish that I had enough money to go ahead and have a home phone as well, because I would. And I've looked into technical, IP phones to reduce. It's all about reducing the cost, though. So from that perspective, yeah, you don't need the home phone. Now, there would be a concern, of course, whether the cell phone is more reliable than the home phone. In my area, cell phone coverage is actually more reliable than the phone service because I live on a street with lots of trees. And the cell towers they put up, normally they clear trees around from them, right? So when a big windstorm happens, the cell phones normally stay up. And the power lines and phone systems of that sort get hit by trees. So from where I live, now if I were in a big flat area, maybe it would be a different thing. Ben, what's your solution right now in the phone space?
My solution right now, I do only have one phone, but I also sometimes call from my computer either via Skype or via Gmail because they have calling.
Great, yeah.
And what I actually use is I use Google Voice. So Google Voice basically will give you one phone number. You can choose to port your current phone number to Google Voice if you want for, I think, a small cost or something. The service itself is free. There's no recurring fee or anything. And what it'll do is people can call your Google Voice number and it'll ring all of your phones. And then you can pick up any of your phones to answer. So from the customer perspective or your friend's perspective, you only have one phone number.
What's clever about that is...
Wait a minute. This is wonderful. You're saying so that if I get Google Voice, it will ring the home phone and my cell phone?
That's
yes,
correct.
And whichever one you answer first will be the one that gets the call.
And
I love that.
And
that's
the ring
exactly
can be,
what I was looking for.
And the ring can be a different type of ring, right? Can you do that?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, but...
When the ring comes through Google Voice, doesn't the ring actually sound a little different or not?
I'm sure you can configure it. I'm not sure that it does on its own.
So that idea of the merging of multiple services into one phone number is a cool idea. And that's a new phone number.
That's true. But of course, you can port it. The additional, the other thing I really like about it is that you can text people from a web interface. So you don't have to use a super duper fancy phone or anything like that with a teeny keypad to text people. You can type them from your full-size QWERTY keyboard on your computer, on your laptop.
I do that a lot when I don't have cell phone coverage. I use my laptop to text. You know,
which
I got to say,
then you'd have to carry the laptop with you when you weren't at home convenient.
Because if you wanted to text that way,
with
yes.
your Android device, if you have any kind of smartphone, you can use Google Voice as well and text from your phone as well.
Right. Definitely look into Google Voice. But let me just say this, Jamie, that the reason why me switching away from a home phone works completely is that I am fanatical about making sure my cell phone is charged and functional and I know where it is. There's like three places my cell phone goes. It's within arm's reach of me. And when I do set it down, it's rare. Like on air right now, I've got it on the table with me, but I know I can't leave it there. It's in my pocket or it's being charged, at my desk. I am really good about not losing that phone. So that if you want to live tethered to a piece of equipment like that, I can't function the same way without my phone. I'm impaired without it. And if you want to change that space, I don't know if that's a good thing to do. I have a lot of judgment about that. My lifestyle is set up to match that, but I don't know. I don't know if it's a good idea. And there's something really wonderful about picking up a phone that has a dial tone. That has a dial tone.
Yeah, it is really nice.
Oh, yeah.
It's nice having
a dial tone.
I miss a dial tone. So I'm not going to recommend that you go away from it all. Definitely play with Google Voice, but this is all dependent on how much you want to get involved in this technical space and kind of geek out a little bit.
Yeah, the most important thing is don't just decide to switch to Google Voice. Go ahead and set up a Google Voice account. If you want to go that direction and take a look at it, set it up. Use it for a month with a couple friends or something like that. And if you really like it and it really works for you, switch to that workflow. But don't just blindly jump and see where you land.
The other option still exists of just dropping the home phone and facing that lots of people do this. And I probably won't necessarily lose the cell phone and so forth.
Yeah, right.
That'd be cheaper.
That's a cheaper way to do it. I mean, you don't have to pay for
one more question. Can you guys say a little bit more about this bill in Congress? How dangerous is this to the Internet?
The SOPA, or Protect Online Privacy.
Yeah, the one that's supposed to be voted on
it's
the 25th.
It's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. But there's some inconsistencies in the bill that are just ridiculous. Like, one of the things that happened is there's a lot of concern that it would break DNS, because fundamentally, a main part of the Internet, this domain name service, it allows you to take, geekspeak.org and point it to the right machine. Without that name, domain names don't work, right? That fundamental function of the Internet, it was breaking that. It was allowing it to not be as reliable. And the government to kind of intercede. Not a good thing. So one of the edits that more recently happened is they added a clause that said, if this breaks DNS, don't do it. So it's kind of like the bill itself is so weird at this point that it would be hard to say you could implement it. So from that perspective, there's one thing. The other thing is large tech companies are thinking about doing a blackout day. This would be Google not working for a day. Or having all, every other word blacked out with black text for a second. Something that would say everybody... in the United States, pay attention, this bill is bad. If one of those companies does it, it's going to get shot down. So I think that all those companies are looking at their should we do it? Should we do it? Facebook could do it, and Twitter could do it, and Google could do it on one for 2 hours, and that bill would die automatically.
Yeah, that'd be pretty interesting.
So it's bad. Where are you? You're in Santa Cruz. Our representative is already aware it's bad. So I wouldn't, in that perspective, what you can do is you can go to AmericanCensorship.org and learn a bit more about it. And I recommend it. Jamie, thanks for the call. We'll go ahead and go right to another call, shall we? Let's go ahead and go to still in Santa Cruz. Susan, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for the program. I have a question. I am not that computer literate, but I have a large collection of albums, and that I want to transfer to digital, and I want to know if you can recommend a software program for
me. Do you have them in vinyl?
I have another question, too.
Do you have them in vinyl right now, or do you have them on tape, or what's your source?
I have everything. I have tape. I have vinyl.
Okay. The simplest way to do this, if you don't want to be geeky...
Sir, could you? I can hardly hear you.
Oh, really? Okay, well...
I can hear you better now.
Okay, good. The simplest answer to this is, if you don't want to become a geek and really learn how to do all this technical stuff, don't try to transfer your music yourself. Someone else has probably already done it. That's one way to think about it. Now, because you own, let's say, what's one of the vinyl you own?
Oh, I have so many.
Oh, just name somebody. Who do you like?
Well, I've got some old Beatles. I've got some old...
Beatles is good.
Everything.
Let's talk about the Beatles canon. Every Beatles song ever recorded is now in a digital format. Absolutely, right? Somebody's already done it. And the question is, how can you get a hold of it without doing that process again?
Well, can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
There's some things that I'd like. I understand what you're saying, but I want to do my own album. I want to do my own program. There's some songs, maybe they're a little bit obscure, that I like.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing is, even those obscure songs, even those songs that are very obscure that you wouldn't think anybody's ever got, most likely they've already been done. The problem is you can't get access to them. The real issue is getting access to these digital files. So you can either pay for that access, meaning it's too complicated, let me just pay somebody and then get the music, right? So, for example, Apple sells a lot of Beatles songs. So you potentially buy them from them at 99 cents a piece, sometimes cheaper. Or you could try to encode yourself.
I don't mind that, but I've got stuff from the 40s.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that you might be able to find that stuff. But let's assume that some of the stuff you have you can't find, or it'd be too expensive or difficult to find. So you want to learn the process of doing this. The best way to encode vinyl onto a computer is to get a USB record player.
Okay, I'm writing this down.
Yeah. A USB record player. So you're getting a turntable that has a USB attachment on it, and you plug it right in your computer.
That will come
with the software necessary to what we call rip vinyl, meaning it gets a copy of it. And then you're going to have a whole bunch of files in your computer system. You're going to have to have more storage on your computer than you used to have, and then you also have to decide what kind of quality you want to save it at when you actually capture it. Most people that are like really audiophiles, if you have an amazing audio system, you want to save it a lot better than the average defaults. I think that people normally encode stuff a lot more with more quality than they can actually hear. But this whole process is going to be, it's not simple. That's your first step, though, a USB record player.
So one of the companies is Ion.
I have a record player. I can't see the brand, but it's got all of the, the bells and whistles. And I bought it specifically for the purpose. And it's got a CD recorder and so on. And then it's got a cassette player and this and that. I wonder, do you think that's sufficient?
If in your manual it says that you can plug it in your computer through USB, then yes. If you do it any other way, you have to deal with getting an audio sample from that system into your computer. Your computer might have a line in. Depends on the type of computer. But the trick is that all of this stuff goes into a depth of technical complexity that is, I don't want to say overwhelming, but it definitely can feel that way sometimes. I mean, I work at UCSC, and I work with highly efficient technical students, right? Graduate students in digital arts, new media. And some of these students can do this kind of thing, and some of them can't, right? And the people that can are nice and it's simple for them. People that can't, it's a learning curve of days or months of time.
Where I would find one of those people?
Well, yeah, it's called Apple. Apple has a lot of this.
Apple?
Well, so these corporations that have music online as a service have a lot of this music already encoded for you. You can probably find it. And that's the simplest way to do it. If you want to capture yourself, Jesse Wilkins here will go, right, Jesse?
Yeah, I mean, I can help you with that. It really depends on, do you want to spend your time on it, or do you want to spend
your phone number? I could reach you.
Well, Jesse Wilkins is at it's not Jesse Wilkins anymore.
Computercentersantacruz.com.
There you go. Hey,
the website.
See, Jesse, you thought this morning you'd just be helping other people.
You know?
In fact, you're getting clientele. So definitely visit Jesse's site. He's a great person to help. He will come to your home for a fee and help you up, set up the Santa thing. You can kind of do the Santa thing, right, Jesse?
Yeah, you know, it sort of gets down to, do you want to spend your time to figure it out, or do you want to pay someone else to do it?
I don't mind paying. I don't mind paying.
Yeah, okay, well, then this is the way to go, because he'll definitely look at that record player and figure out how to hook it up to your computer. I mean, that, you know, that having a geek in your house, it's a nice service.
Well, do you have a number that I could reach?
Sure.
Yeah,
go ahead,
so area code 831-588-4319.
Okay, and then my next question is probably very simple. I just bought this Reach Out, the government-assisted wireless service.
Uh-huh.
And I'm trying to hook it up, and I don't quite know how. Do you have any suggestions?
Jesse can help with that, too. That's definitely an in-house kind of setup.
Yeah, I haven't looked into that yet, but we could definitely figure it out together.
Thank you, Susan, for the call.
All right.
Again, Jesse, if you're interested in Jesse's consulting service, it's what is it again? Computer Center Santa Cruz? Yay. ComputerCenterSantaCruz.com. His phone number is 831-588-4319. Well, let's go ahead and go to San Francisco, I think. It'd be fun. Hi, Ryan. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I just wanted to go back briefly to antivirus on Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And in the past, I have also recommended AVG to people who I'm helping with their computers.
It's a standard GeekSpeak thing, too. Sure.
Sure. But recently, I found AVG to start becoming very bloated, kind of like what Norton, in my experience, became. And it would slow down computers. So now I actually recommend Microsoft Security Essentials, which is actually a free program from Microsoft. I found it very good and just stays in the background until problems occur.
Yeah, I like Security Essentials because it's a pretty light program, like you're saying. The only thing I don't really like about it is there's not too many, you know, for us who like to modify the settings and preferences and schedule your own scans, you know, like I like to turn off my automatic scans and then run them manually, where it doesn't really let you do that. But it is a great light antivirus piece of software, I agree.
Sure. And I've never noticed it really slowing down my computer significantly, unlike some of the other applications.
Certainly. Yeah,
Thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, and it brings you back to the packages thing, the suites, where if they have a whole bunch of pieces of software doing stuff together, it can definitely slow your computer down.
Certainly.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I was in San Francisco 2.5 hours ago.
We get you down here every once in a while.
Cars are amazing. I like trains better, though.
Dimitri from Aptos, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
So anyways, my mother has a question about, it's a computer security question, about when a computer goes to sleep, is it still connected to the network and can it still send and receive packets?
When it's asleep?
Technically?
No, when it's asleep.
Yeah, when it's asleep or suspended.
When it's so a computer can have a sleep on LAN thing, which means that when a LAN connectivity, when something pings it or connects it to it, it can wake the machine up. But if it's, but you'll know if that was happening because the fans would come on. You'd hear it turn on. So no, basically, when the machine's asleep, you don't really have to concern yourself with that. You guys agree with that?
Yeah, I agree with that. I say technically, yes, it can definitely receive packets. It's called actually magic packets. If anyone on the anyone listening to the sound of my voice wants to look it up, it's kind of cool. But technically, yes. But as far as what you have to be worried about, no, you don't have to worry about vulnerabilities.
There you go. Thank you, Dimitri.
Does this functionality require the wake on LAN feature of a,
yes,
a motherboard?
Yes.
The NIC.
Yeah. If you enable that, then the machine will wake up with a certain type of network probe. But keep in mind that any time your machine, I mean, because it's in that space and it could potentially do that, there might be a vulnerability in the BIOS that would allow it to happen even when it's not enabled. So, but that would be a pretty, it would be a bug.
It's unlikely.
It's unlikely. And at the same time, if it did emerge, we probably wouldn't mention it on the show because it's such a small concern that it's not that big a deal. Is that fair? The other thing to do is don't have your computer connected directly to the internet, right? have a router in between. If you've got a router, you've got one level of protection. They have to get into your router then before to contact your machine. So your machine's even doubly protected, if you will. And if you don't know what that means, you have to look it up, unfortunately, because we probably can't do it on air.
And then for this type of thing, it's like sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I've had varying levels of like success myself trying to set it up and get it to work properly.
Yeah, me too, actually. It's a tough thing to get to work. The other thing is, I think by default, many or most, I'm not sure if most or many is the right thing to say, most of them or many of them are set by default to not be turned on. So even if they have the capability to do it, usually the BIOS is set to not respond to magic packets. So,
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
We're coming up at the end of the hour. I want to mention that we did get a call from Ed at Password Robust who definitely has a concern about cell phones and home lines. Unfortunately, he hung up before we were able to take it. But I'm sure that it's about reliability and that kind of concern. You know, I mean, the other thing is I lose power for days on end, right? So sometimes I'll lose power for a week at my home. And during that time, I really can't charge my phone, and my phone will run out of juice at a certain period of time. The landlines, lots of times, work even when the power lines go down. So there's that kind of trade-off.
Well, granted, you need to have a non-portable phone.
Non-powered phone.
Right in the wall.
Yeah. I remember for years I was carrying around a phone that was didn't need external power besides the phone line. And then Bradley from Santa Cruz suggests that couldn't students, I would assume in high school, maybe even college, get credit in exchange for helping people out in their homes with their tech. I think it's a good idea. I could see a computer club or computer class at a high school level doing that. Working for people in their home is a very touchy thing, right?
Yeah.
So I used to do this business too, and whenever I did it, after I finished, I passed my two clients to Jesse. But one of the things is you're going into someone's home, you're sitting at their desk and in their environment. That's weird right off the bat. Then you're dealing with their very personal stuff. And you can decide, I think it makes sense to clean this drive. I'll go ahead and erase this drive, reformat, and install Windows. Do you have a backup of this? Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's move forward. Erase, backup. Oh, it's working now. Great. Where's my stuff? It's in your backup. Oh, where's that? I had it on the same drive. I mean, you can't, you come into a place where you are very much the support role, the power role, the person that's managing what's happening. You're not like you're helping someone. It's like, you're holding up somebody in some sense when you touch their computer. You have to be excessively patient and careful. And I've had friends that are extremely technical, really good at what they do in the geek space, have them on the show, they're awesome, and they'll go in and make a mistake like erasing someone's music collection or photos because they just made a simple mistake. So you've got to have a really regimented, detailed way of thinking about things or you're not going to be successful and you're going to really piss people off. So I think that having a high school program doing that, I think you'd have to work under someone that had that skill set to really get that skill.
Yeah, you'd have to have that. Plus, you'd have to have like a support organization type of thing in charge of it to give you credit. And if you want to officially do it like that.
It's a cool idea,
tricky.
Though. Would you, Jesse, would you be interested in doing something like that?
It's a possibility. I'm new enough that it's tricky for me to even venture in that direction. But eventually, yeah, I'd love to have some, support and teach kids and young people how to do it. Yeah.
Jesse Wilkins joined us. He's ComputerCenterSantaCruz.com. Ben Jaffe joined me today as well. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. For GeekSpeak and for KOSP, I'm Lyle Troxell. The show will be up at GeekSpeak.org relatively soon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.